From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, retired Army Sergeant Clifford Stone joins us. Crashed UFO retrievals. Some of you may remember this story. Happened about 20-plus years ago. The FBI says it has launched a complete new review of all evidence in the unsolved 1982 Tylenol poisonings that killed 7 people in the Chicago area. The statement comes the same day federal agents searched the Boston area home of a man convicted of extortion in the aftermath of these poisonings. No one was ever charged with the deaths of those who took the cyanide-laced drugs. FBI agents searched the Cambridge, Massachusetts home of James Lewis. Lewis served 12 years in prison for extortion after sending a note to Tylenol maker Johnson & Johnson demanding $1 million to stop the killing. An Illinois lawmaker is proposing a law he hopes will stop the violence that takes the lives of young people. The legislation is called Blair's Bill, named after high school student Blair Holt. He died after using his body to shield and save the life of a female friend during a shooting on a bus. In a moment, researcher John Lott joins us as we talk about guns. The Senate has voted to give a tax break of up to $15,000 to homebuyers in hopes of revitalizing the housing industry. Now, this is a victory for Republicans eager to leave their mark on a mammoth economic stimulus bill at the heart of President Barack Obama's recovery plan. The proposal would allow a tax credit of 10% of the value of new or existing residences up to a $15,000 limit. Current law provides for a $7,500 tax break for the purchase of new homes only. The proposal would cost us an estimated $19 billion. President Barack Obama has announced a $500,000 limit on executive pay at U.S. firms that need substantial fresh government aid. The move follows widespread public anger over the levels of pay on Wall Street, but it's not expected to be applied to past deals. President Obama said it was shameful that top bankers had awarded themselves giant bonuses last year. He added that taxpayers should not be subsidizing excessive compensation. Now, everybody makes mistakes, right? God knows I've made mine. But House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi, she blundered big time. She held a news conference telling of unprecedented layoffs in the United States if the stimulus package doesn't get passed. Basically, Pelosi says that if legislators don't move quickly to pass President Barack Obama's stimulus package, 500 million Americans will lose their jobs every month.
Every month that we do not have an economic recovery package, 500 million Americans lose their jobs. I don't think we can go fast enough to stop that.
Now, that was every month. Now, last time I counted, we had about 305 million Americans in the country. So if we lost 500 million jobs every month, you're talking about 6 billion Americans out of work in a year. That was a blunder. Gerald Celente, founder, director of the Trends Research Institute, today's number one trend analyst. Gerald, I think she was off by a few zeros, huh?
Yeah, just a couple.
Tell me about this housing stimulus package. What's that going to do for us?
Well, George, as you mentioned, you know, there was a $7,500 tax break, and that did nothing, and neither will the $15,000 tax break. It's short-sighted, and it's really not going to do much. According, actually, even to the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and they made a very good point. They said that home buyers would still have trouble getting access to mortgages because of the continued tightness in the credit markets. And the fellow pushing it, as you mentioned also, it's a Republican victory from Senator Johnny Isaacson. And he's a former real estate broker. It couldn't be funnier. And he's the prime sponsor. And he's looking back to 1974 and using that as a benchmark when we had a $2,000 home buyer credit. So comparing this to 1974, It's like Nancy Pelosi comparing the unemployment rate that we have now to 500 million people.
They're going to pass this stimulus measure one way or another, Gerald. I'm not sure it's going to make a difference here. So let's assume they pass it, they pump the money back into the economy somehow, and nothing really happens. Then what do we do?
They're going to come up with something else. Remember, they told us the same exact thing, George, last September when they were pushing through the $700 billion TARP program that ballooned into $850 billion. It's not going to work. This is a global financial meltdown. We're talking $500 trillion worth of credit swap fault derivatives that are useless that are coming onto the market. This is going to be a drop in the bucket. They're just going to keep pumping and asking us for more money.
He's one of the best. Gerald Celente, his website, trendsresearch.com. Gerald, thank you. Drivers better buckle up or pay the price. More cash-strapped states want to give law enforcement officers the authority to pull over motorists just for not wearing their seatbelts. Now, more than a dozen states that are considering making the switch to primary seatbelt enforcement laws need to do so before July in order to be eligible for millions of dollars in federal money. One of those states, for example, is Ohio, which would get $26.8 million if it changes its law. Currently, officers in Ohio must first have some other reason to stop drivers before issuing seatbelt citations. The U.S. House has voted to postpone the planned transition from analog to digital television broadcasting, which was supposed to take effect February 17th. They've postponed it now to June 12th. Those in favor of the delay fear that too many Americans aren't ready for the switchover. Those opposed held that a delay could cost broadcasters and further confusion. Stations have the option of sticking with the Feb 17 date. The Nielsen Company, well, they estimated that more than 6.5 million U.S. households that rely on analog television sets, kind of like with the rabbit ears, to pick up over-the-air broadcast signals could see their TV set simply go dark if the transition was not approved. Simply measuring a woman's resting pulse rate can predict how likely she is to suffer a heart attack, according to a study in a new British medical journal. U.S. researchers also looked at the records of around 129,000 women who had no history of heart problems. They found that those with the highest heart rates were significantly more likely to suffer a heart attack than the women with the lowest rates. Well-known former Chicago radio personality Eddie Schwartz has died of kidney and lung and heart failure. Schwartz started in radio as a teenager and became a radio legend in Chicago over several decades at several stations. Known as Chicago Ed, Schwartz spent much of his time on the overnight airwaves there. His radio career ended in 1995. He was 62. Fossils from northeastern Colombia revealed the biggest snake ever discovered. Now, this thing stretches 42 to 45 feet long, reaching more than 2,500 pounds. Jack Conrad of the American Museum of Natural History in New York, who's very familiar with this discovery of these fossils, said it could have easily have eaten anything the size of a cow. A human, he says, would just be toast immediately. John Lott Jr. is a senior research scholar at the University of Maryland. He received his Ph.D. in economics from UCLA in 1984, was chief economist at the United States Sentencing Commission during 88 and 89. John has published over 100 articles in academic journals. He's the author of six books, including More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws, The Bias Against Guns, and most frequently, Freedomnomics. And we're going to talk with John about Freedomnomics sometime in March with a complete show. Here he is to talk about the Blair Holt Act, which could become law one day. John, welcome back to Coast to Coast. How are you, John?
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Good. John, this situation with this act that would control licensing, how would this work if it happened to be passed?
You're talking about with regard to concealed handguns or licensing
primarily.
Well, you know, the notion of licensing guns generally is put forward as a way of solving crime. That if a criminal commits a crime and they have a registered gun and they leave it at the crime scene, then it's possible to go and trace the gun back to the criminal. The problem is that we have places either in the United States or around the world that have both licensing and registration. And there's no evidence that they're actually able to solve crimes using. And you look, we have Hawaii, for example, has had licensing and registration for about 50 years. A couple years ago, the Hawaii police chief and other police chiefs admitted that they could not point to one single crime that they've been able to solve as a result of licensing and registration. Canada has had licensing and registration of handguns since the 1930s. And there's only a couple crimes, literally like two, that they can point to that they've been able to solve. And you have other cities like Chicago or New York City. And there's a very simple reason why this doesn't work. And that is, first of all, very rarely is a crime gun actually registered to the criminal.
That's true.
That's there. And secondly, criminals very rarely leave their guns at the scene. If they do leave the gun at the scene, it's either because the criminal's been either seriously wounded or killed. And so the number of crimes where you can actually go and use that type of information is extremely small. And the problem that you have with these types of costs that you impose on people for going and registering guns, paying fees, is that you make it more costly and difficult for good law-abiding citizens to own guns. The problem that you have with gun control laws generally is that we all want to try to take guns away from criminals. But the problem is who's most likely to obey the laws? Because if my work, for example, finds that it's basically poor people who live in high-crime urban areas who benefit the most from having the option to be able to have a gun to protect themselves, simply because they're so much more likely to be victims of crime. And you go and impose fees for licensing and registration. It's basically the poorest people that you're going to price out of being able to own a gun. And so what you end up doing is actually, in many of these cases, actually increasing crime rates rather than reducing them, because you make it so that the law-abiding citizens are more vulnerable.
Absolutely.
To being attacked.
John in St. Louis, an alderman a few months ago in his area, told his constituency, look, the police can't protect all of you. You should be carrying your own guns.
Right.
And you have shown, when you did a lot of research years ago, that states that passed concealed carry laws, crime actually went down. Am I correct?
That's right. Right. No, that's right. Look, I mean, it'd be great if the police were there to protect people all the time. My research finds that police are the single most important factor for reducing crime. But something that I think the police understand themselves is that they virtually always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's occurred. And that raises questions. Well, what do you advise someone to do when they're having to confront a criminal by themselves? And simply telling people to behave passively is actually very dangerous advice. By far, the safest course of action for people to take when they're confronted by a criminal is to have a gun.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
You basically have two things that happen when citizens own guns. One is you deter some criminals from attacking. Just like higher arrest rates or higher conviction rates or longer prison sentences make crime riskier for criminals to commit, the fact that a victim might be able to defend themselves can also deter some criminals. When I was chief economist of the Sentencing Commission, I literally must have read through over 1,000 transcripts from trials. And it's amazing how similar things transpire in those cases. So you often have a robbery where you have two robbers and you have the government will get one robber to turn evidence against another. And they'll ask them the same types of questions. So why did you pick this particular victim to go after? And they'll say time after time, it was because he looked like an easy mark. You know, we knew the drug dealer down the street had a lot of money. But, you know, he had guns. We weren't going to go after him. That would have been crazy for us to go and do. Or they'll say, maybe we could go after a cab driver. But cab drivers, many places, also carry guns. And so they'd see somebody that looked like a musician type or somebody who wasn't able to go and defend themselves very well. And that would be the person that they would pick. Or some woman who looked like an easy prey also would be the type of person that they would pick to go after. Criminals are no different than anybody else in the sense that if they see an easier way of committing a crime, they're going to take that easier way out. And having victims which are easier prey and less able to defend themselves is one way that they care a lot about trying to go after.
And if they're in states that they know there's a high probability that someone is not carrying a gun because that particular state, let's say, just makes it difficult for someone to have one, they know, as you just said, that person is indeed an easy mark.
That's right. The thing is, people who don't even carry guns benefit from the fact that other people do. Because the criminal doesn't know until he actually attacks someone whether that person's going to be able to defend themselves or not. So people would never think of owning a gun benefit from the fact that other people are willing to bear those costs of carrying the gun and going through the permitting process and paying the money to buy the gun.
John, in Missouri, they voted twice for concealed carry, failed the first time, finally passed several years ago the second time. Most rank-and-file police officers in Missouri were in favor of this. It was the police chief and it was the politician, those folks, they didn't want this passed.
Right. Well, nationwide, you see about 76% or so of the rank-and-file police officers support right to carry laws.
Yes.
You see less among police chiefs. It's still a majority, but it's more barely a majority. You see something around 58%. I think when you're talking about large urban areas, there's lots of politics that go into these things. I think guns are one easy way that police or chiefs or politicians in major areas can say, well, look, we're doing something. We're trying to ban these guns. The problem is, you look at bans or other types of regulations like that, they very frequently have the opposite impact. I know people often want to say, well, at least they're doing something there. But you look at the experiences in places like Washington, D.C. or Chicago, where we instituted bans, and we saw big increases in murder rates in those places. D.C. had only 1 year after its ban went into effect where the murder rate was as low as it was prior to the ban going into effect. But that's, whether it's opposition to concealed carry or just bans of guns in general, I think it's easy to go and try to pick something that's more symbolic to try to claim that they're doing something about the problem, even if it's counterproductive.
John, in some areas where some of these young children and students have gone crazy, literally crazy, and they've shot up their schoolrooms and they've killed so many people. And then we find out later that they were under severe depression, they were taking prescription drugs. A lot of this, the root of the cause of what was happening to them. But the argument was always they got guns. They grabbed guns, either took guns from their parents, but they got guns. Is that a legitimate argument that these kids would not have been able to do what they did had they not been able to get the guns so easily?
Well, I think if you have a situation where somebody's planning months and months or even a year in advance, it's very difficult, whether it's Virginia Tech or some other type of attack,
Columbine,
to prevent somebody from going and getting guns. My concern is that if you look at any of these multiple victim public shootings in the United States that involve more than three people being killed, every single one of them has had one common characteristic, and that is they've occurred in places where civilians are banned from having guns. Bill Landis and I, Bill Landis at the University of Chicago, and I looked at all the multiple victim public shootings in the United States from 1977 through 1999. And what we found is that the normal types of ways you stop crime, like higher arrest rates and higher conviction rates and longer prison sentences, didn't matter for these particular types of crimes. And there's a simple reason for that, and that is virtually always these guys die at the scene. About 75% of the time, and even the remaining 25%, they thought they were going to die when you look at interviews afterwards. None of the gun control laws mattered except for one, and that was passage of right-to-carry laws. When states passed right-to-carry laws, there was about 60% drop in the rate at which attacks occurred and an 80% drop in the rate at which people were killed or injured. And the question is, why is it so big? I mean, you look at murder rates generally, you may see a 1.5%, maybe 2% drop in murder for each additional year that a right to carry law is in effect. Why do you see these massive drops there? And I think it's the same general principle that if you make crime riskier, you see greater drops. And having, even if there's only a 5% chance that any one person in a public area might have a permit, somebody, when you have 100 adults or 50 adults that's going to be able to defend themselves, is going to be extremely high, and you see greater deterrence.
Absolutely. Right, John, we'll be back with phone calls with you in a moment. Well, just so you know it, our guest this hour, John Lott, has a blog, and it's linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. John Lott, in your opinion, is government trying to just keep records of where all these guns are, or do they want them off the streets and out of our hands?
Well, in other countries where you've seen registration licensing occur, it's often ended up being a way to go and keep track of the guns to eventually get rid of them. And I think that's a fear that a lot of people have here in the United States. If there was some evidence that licensing and registration rules like that actually reduce crime, then there would be something to talk about there. But when they can't even point to crimes that have been solved in any of these cities in the United States that have had licensing and registration, or a place like Hawaii or other countries, it really makes one wonder why anybody would want to propose spending the millions of dollars that would have to, or even billions of dollars that have to be spent on that, particularly at a national level. Because there's so many other things you could spend the money on to reduce crime, things that we know that work. They'd just be a waste of money.
Absolutely. Let's go to the phones. We'll go to Houston, Texas to start. Mike is on the wild card line. Mike, go ahead. You're on with John Lott.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
George,
good.
Excellent show as always. I have a question for your guest. It's kind of a hypothetical, but very realistic. It's no secret that Biden and Obama are strongly anti-gun. And if they try to pass a legislation that institutes a countrywide gun ban, how many civilian, military, and police casualties do you think will incur due to this negative and senseless piece of legislation, if it happens? And I'll go ahead and take my answer off the air.
All right. Speculation, John Lott. Do you want to go there?
Right. Well, I don't think they're going to be able to pass a law that's going to ban all guns. I think if you look at the experience, whenever people have tried to pass a gun ban, again, whether it's like in D.C. or Chicago, you've seen increases in murder rates. I don't know of one place around the world where you've imposed a gun ban that you haven't seen increases in murder rates. One comment that's often made saying, well, you can't really expect it to have worked well in places like D.C. or Chicago because there's so many other places that people could go and get guns. But you can look at where they've tried to have bans, even in island nations like Ireland or Jamaica or even England, and you see what happens there, that they have increases in murder rates and other types of violent crime rates there because it's basically the law-abiding good citizens who are disarmed. Now, they're going to try not a complete gun ban, but they're going to push, obviously, a new assault weapons ban, and there's going to be other types of regulations that they're going to impose. I knew Barack Obama at the University of Chicago. We both taught there. We overlapped there for about 4 years. And the first time that I met him, the comment that he made to me was that he didn't believe people should be able to own guns. And if you look at his positions while he was in the state Senate there in Illinois, he did support banning all handguns. He came out with a questionnaire saying that he supported the ban on all semi-automatic guns, which would be the vast majority of guns that are sold in the United States. And he had things like supporting a ban on the sale of guns within 5 miles of a school or a park, which effectively in over 40 states in the country would ban the sale of guns if something like that were to go through. But I don't think there are a lot of bad laws that I think are likely to get passed, but I don't think they're going to go that far right now anyway.
How did they pass these gun laws in Britain, for example, John? How did they get these things passed? Or even Australia, they're pretty aggressive taking guns away there too, aren't they?
Right. Well, I think just think of how people get a lot of their views on guns. I think it's natural. If you constantly hear about bad things that happen with guns, and never hear about any of the benefits, then the natural reaction a lot of people have is, well, if I simply remove the guns, then there won't be the crime. What people don't think about or don't hear about are all the defensive uses that occur with guns. Research that I did a few years ago, I looked at all the news reports during 2001 for the top 100 newspapers as well as for the national television networks. And if you looked at ABC, NBC, and CBS, they had about 190,000 words worth of news stories on gun crimes. They did not have one single story that entire year of a citizen using a gun to protect themselves, to protect somebody else.
Right.
You look at New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and USA Today that year. Between the three newspapers, there was one story in the New York Times of 163 words in length at the back of the newspaper of a retired police officer who had used a gun to stop a crime. That impacts people's perceptions about the costs and benefits of guns. Most people will be surprised that if you look at surveys, because that's often the only way we can tell a lot of things with regard to crime, there are about 400 to 450,000 crimes committed each year with guns, according to surveys done by the Justice Department. By contrast, similar surveys indicate that people use guns defensively about 2 million times a year. That's about 4 to 5 times more frequently each year people use guns to stop crime than they use them to commit them. But you would never know that just by watching the news. Now, I think a lot of that can be understood in the sense that if you're an editor of a news bureau and you have two stories that come across your desk, one case there's a dead body on the ground, sympathetic person like a victim, mm-hmm. or another case, let's say a woman's brandished a gun, the would-be attackers run away, no shots are fired, no dead body on the ground, and that's about 95% or so of the times that people use guns defensively, that's what happens, that I think anybody would make the same news call that the first story is a lot more newsworthy than the second one,
right.
even though we may care about both from a policy perspective in terms of what types of actions are going to save or cost lives. But even though you can understand and explain why the media covers a lot of the stories the way it does, it still has a real impact on people's perceptions about the costs and benefits from guns. When I go around and give talks on the issue of guns, there's so many times I run into people who say that they've never heard of a defensive gun use, and it can't do anything but color their impressions. I think there are lots of problems, though, that do involve some type of media bias. I'll just give you one simple example, and that is you talked about these multiple victim public shootings before. Relatively few people know that almost 30% of the school-related multiple-victim public school shootings in the United States have been stopped by citizens with guns before the police were able to arrive. And the reason why people are not likely to know that is that even when that occurs, even when you already have an extremely newsworthy event, that particular part of the story is systematically left out of the news coverage. You look at the first of the public school shootings in Pearl, Mississippi in 1997, in which two people were killed. There was an assistant principal there at the school who had a permit to carry a concealed handgun, a former Marine, who regularly would carry his concealed handgun with him on school property up until the end of 95 when the Safe School Zone Act was passed.
Right.
After that, he would lock his gun in his car, park it a quarter of a mile off of school property to obey the 1,000-foot rule. When the attack started that day, he literally had to run a half mile to get his gun, a half mile back. And held the attacker at point-blank range for 5.5 minutes before the police arrived. The attacker was leaving the high school to go across the street to the middle school to continue his attack there. Now, if you do what's called a nexus search, which is a computerized news search of news stories, in the 1 month after that attack, you'll find 687 separate news stories around the country about the attack. Of those, only 19 mentioned the assistant principal in any way.
And that he should have been a hero.
You would think so.
Yeah.
You would think so. Only 13 mentioned that he had something to do with stopping the attack, and only 10 stories, 8 of them in local media near where the attack had occurred, mentioned that he used a gun to stop the attack. But you can go through other places like Edinburgh, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, there was a case, Santee, California, where you have citizens stopping these attacks before uniformed police were able to arrive. And you regularly find about 1% of the news coverage in those cases mentioning that a citizen with a gun stopped the attack. If a police officer stops the attack, you'll find about 36% of the news stories will mention that that's the case. And, you know, when I was writing one of my previous books, The Bias Against Guns, there was an attack at the Appalachian Law School in Virginia in which three people were killed that was stopped by two students there who had run to their cars and gotten their permanent concealed handguns from their cars and come back and ordered the attacker to the ground, and a third student and them held them until police arrived. And I had been on Larry Elder's radio show, national show at that time, with one of the students, Tracy Bridges. And Tracy had been saying how he had gone and talked to like 50 newspaper outlets the day of the attack. And being a law school student, he had used Nexus and Westlaw and these other computerized news searches to go and see how, the quotes from him.
Sure.
And he couldn't find
him. He couldn't find him.
And so I decided to go and call up the reporters. I called up over 50 reporters just to find out, one, did they know about the facts there? And two, if they did, why did they report it the way they did? And virtually all the reporters had either talked to one or both of the students who had used their guns to stop the attacks. And when I asked them, well, why then didn't you mention that in your stories? Maria Glad at the Washington Post, for example, gave me the typical response, and she said she only had 913 words to do the story.
Jeez.
And simply didn't have enough space to get into it. What she says in the said in the story was that the students had tackled the attacker, which is true, but it gives the impression that somehow these students were running across an open field against an armed attacker,
yeah,
which is probably not very good advice to go and give people. And what had happened was I said, well, don't you think it would be more newsworthy to go and mention the students who'd used their guns to stop the attacker? What would get other people who are reading the stories to go and tell their friends, geez, did you see what I just read? To go and simply say the students tackled the attacker, or to go and say the students used their guns to stop the attacker? And my guess is, particularly given people's impressions about how guns are used, I think it would be much more newsworthy. I mean, before we talked about how the newsworthiness kind of went in the other way in terms of explaining what could get covered. In this case, in many of these similar cases where you're already talking about a story that's getting national or international coverage, you just find time after time that that particular part of the story gets left out.
Let's go to Scott, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Go ahead, Scott.
Yes, sir. I really appreciate your guests being there.
Sure thing.
It's rare to hear such a positive view of gun ownership coming from someone as respected as he is. And he was talking earlier about police response, which brought a quote to mind that says, "When seconds count, police are minutes away." And whenever I'm a police officer in Fort Wayne, so whenever we're dealing with situations where you have armed citizenry, that's one of the things that, you know, that you want to come across is that, we're not going to be there. We're not going to be there all the time. We are a reactive group. There's times when we're able to be on scene of things and be able to stop it before it happens. But most often or not, we respond. You know, a call comes in and we respond and we get there after the fact.
Yeah, very rarely, Scott, are you there when the event is occurring.
Right, exactly. I mean, we've had recently we've had a couple of officer involved shootings, that just happens. But normally, you know, we've had more often than not, you know, we may be within blocks of it, but still in all the shootings or the incidents occurred, and we're basically there to take the names and the pictures and everything else. We had just recently within the last few months had Colonel Grossman wrote the book on killing. You familiar with him?
John, do you know him?
I know him a little bit, yes.
Okay.
He was here talking. He did a talk, and one of the things that he pointed out was he's done research and everything into these a lot of the high school shootings. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, sir, but didn't in some of the cases you had the kids were really didn't have any kind of expertise in firearms, but it had to do with a lot of things that they'd learned from video games when it came to single shot. You know, the higher the higher the body count, the more points you score, the more the less ammunition you use.
Well, I mean, I think it's clear that a lot of these people didn't have expertise in guns by any means. One thing that's driven a lot of these people, and you see this in diaries or other things that they leave, has been to try to kill as many people as possible because that's one way that they can get attention. A lot of these are viewed as a way of committing suicide, and they'd like to go out with as big of a bang as possible. And that's one reason why they like to try to avoid doing these attacks where people could respond. One thing people may not know is if you remember the Columbine case,
And you're breaking up on us, John, here. So with only a couple minutes left, I'll take the remaining phone calls here for you and try to get everybody's views on this situation. John Lott, of course, his blog is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And he will be back in March. His latest work is called Freedomnomics. And you're going to love what he has to say about that. Let's go next to Jeff in Patton, Maine, on our wildcard line. You're up with us. Jeff, John's not with us, but let's hear what you were going to say.
Hey, John. I'm stretching, George. I'm a retired police officer, 26 years. Did a small department. I was on a small department up in the Northeast and on the largest department down in the Southeast. Rank and file, most of the cops I was talking to, we discussed this in a lot of situations. We were all four people having guns. Honest citizens is no problem because they would, on some occasions, be there to help you out.
Absolutely. They're trained. They're dedicated. They're honest, as you say. The criminals already have the guns.
That's right. They don't care. And it's a joke. They sit there, they'll laugh at you. But you'll find most of the times that the chiefs of these departments or some politician maybe has some sway over them or the budget that will jump on the bandwagon and try to say that they want gun control, they want to take guns away. And then, as the other police officer said, that we're a reactive agency. We're not proactive. And if somebody decides, say you got a psychopath living next to you or someplace close to you, and if he's smart enough, he says to you, I'm going to shoot you and your family. You got four choices. And the four choices are call the police. They can't sit around and stake your house out, so that's probably a waste of time. Second one is to run, get the heck out of the area. Third is to arm yourself and protect yourself and your family if you honestly believe this guy is. Now, fourth thing is, I probably shouldn't say this, but is to be proactive and go after him. But those are the four choices you have. And I have been in, we've been riots down in Miami, et cetera, and I have been in situations where the police department, in their expertise, will say that if I think they're probably lying, or one of the biggest lies perpetrated, one of the biggest, there's a whole bunch now going on, but is that the police or anybody can protect anybody in their homes. We can't.
No, you can't. You are, again, you react to what has happened. John, we've got 30 seconds. We got you right back again.
Right.
I wanted to thank you
in
person.
I agree completely. My research finds the police are the single most important factor for reducing crime, but it's because they represent a threat eventually to those criminals of being caught and put in jail. And the question is, what do you advise people to do when they're having to confront a criminal by themselves? And having a gun is consistently by far the safest course of action for people to take.
And an issue that will not go away. Thank you, John Lott. Clifford Stone joins us next, former Army sergeant with incredible crash retrieval stories.